Hello, welcome to Lennox Lads, episode 97. As usual, I'm joined by Mike, Amalith and Connor. Say hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everybody.
This week, we are talking about just some cool software projects that we found recently and, you know, a little bit of news on some open source topics. So a nice chatty episode. No main topic this week because we haven't talked about like cool projects in a while. Before we go any further, just a quick shout out on our site. You can go to linuxlads.com/contact. You can get all our contact details there. You can even get our individual Mastodon handles if you want to go do that. Anyway, let's get the show on the road. So first up, I wanted to shout out, this is probably something I've mentioned on the show before, but Zettler, which is a Markdown editor, because I've been searching for kind of the perfect Markdown editor for a while, you know, that can contain all my thoughts and random ideas and stuff that I don't want to forget. And I've been looking around a few, like I tried Joplin before, but the one drawback with Joplin, it was great, but the one drawback was that it would sync all of your Markdown files with these like gobbledygook names that only made sense within the application. And I just didn't like that because I wanted just like a database of Markdown files essentially. And I wanted to have the files be the names that I gave to them, not some random internal format name. So that kind of didn't work because I would like portability as well and to be able to open the files in other applications. So Joplin didn't really work there. Then I tried Obsidian, which isn't open source, but is amazing and is actually really good, and played around with a lot of the plugins and stuff and the DataView plugin and stuff like that, which was really fun. It's kind of almost like a SQL sort of thing within your Markdown document, so you can have like very dynamic templates and stuff that like auto generate stuff and take snippets from other documents and stuff like that. It's just really powerful and really fun.
I've used Obsidian. I've paid for the sync service. I've even paid for the publishing service that lets you sort of turn your notes into an publicly accessible knowledge base, sort of, and it's really cool. I didn't realize it was not open source until you said it.
No, I mean, they're kind of open source adjacent. They're one of those companies that like, we're cool with open source. We're just not open source.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of sympathy towards us, but they just don't have an open source element to their stuff.
Right.
However, yeah, so Obsidian, I can't remember what it was that made me stop using it. I think it was just actually too overwhelming because I had a really cool setup there. I was using sync thing to sync all the files between different devices. It actually worked really nicely. So it's like a cloud kind of storage, but without having your data on anyone else's computer, essentially. So it worked out really nicely. But yeah, I think it just became a bit too overwhelming. There was so much stuff you could do with Obsidian that it just became a bit dense and a bit like overwhelming sometimes. So I needed something a little bit more simple. So Zettler is kind of scratches that itch. It just like fits in. It has some nice handy dandy features and nifty stuff, you know, if you want it, but mostly it's just like, hey, this is a Markdown editor. You know, you have your vaults or your workspaces or whatever you want to call them, like where you have where all your certain documents for a certain project live. And, you know, that's all I need. I'll go to Amalith next. You've been trying out NextDNS. So tell us why it's wonderful.
So NextDNS is a recursive DNS resolving service. Well, I don't know whether it's recursive or not, but it is a DNS resolver. So you make your account. It's like $20 a year or something, and you can have unlimited devices and unlimited queries and unlimited profiles. And each profile allows you to configure like ad blocking stuff and malware blocking stuff. It's really simple to use. All of your devices using NextDNS as their resolver just simply won't resolve like Google Analytics domains, for example, or Facebook domains, or Microsoft domains, or any of that. uBlock Origin and similar extensions are definitely better in browsers for like cosmetic filtering to actually remove the ad element from the web page. But if you're like using apps on your phone, you can't exactly install uBlock Origin in your phone app. That's where NextDNS comes in. It just won't resolve those ad serving domains. It's like Pi-hole as a service, so you don't have to manage it yourself. But what those different profiles allow you to do is have different configurations for different devices.
On your smartphone, if you point it at the DNS, it would work over both Wi-Fi and data. So when you're out and about, it would still do it.
Mm-hmm.
Going to go to Mike next. No laptop for 2 weeks and Endeavor OS works out of the box. So what's this all about?
Yeah, I've been on holidays without a laptop, which doesn't happen often enough as it should. But it's a great experience just to switch off for a while. I mean, I still have my phone, but I use it only for if I need to look up something on Wikipedia or for, light things, really. Then I came back and opened my laptop, and then this morning my NVMe drive failed. So I scrambled before this recording to replace the NVMe drive with the original one and install some distribution. So I set on Endeavor OS with GNOME, and it works nicely, actually. I like the installer. I like the post-install kind of helper that turns up on your screen and lets you set up the mirrors and lets you, you know, all the configurations of Arch without having to look up how to do it. And, you know, it's basically the discoverability is strong with Endeavor OS. I haven't tried it for a while, and I'm liking it. They've recently added the option to the installer to choose your bootloader, systemd bootloader or grub or none as well, if you want to provide your own. It looks pretty decent. And I got from computer that wouldn't boot to a machine that I can record on within 2 hours, and that includes unscrewing the whole thing and replacing the drive and install and download and everything. So yeah, pretty good.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm running Endeavor OS as well, and I really like it. I've used some things distros based on Arch before, and I've always gone back to Endeavor OS. Surprisingly enough, even though Manjaro touts themselves as something that's more stable than Arch, I actually found with my specific setup, so your mileage may vary, but I've actually found it to be the opposite, that I found that Endeavor OS is way more stable than for me.
My experience as well, in fact, when I took the old NVMe that I use as a replacement, I found that there is a Manjaro install from 2020, and when I tried to boot from it, I got the bootloader shell or whatever it is called. It didn't boot, so there clearly had been some issues back then on it as well.
Needless to say, Endeavor OS is stable if you do updates semi-regularly, like every couple of days or every week or so or something like that. But if you left Endeavor OS for several months, your mileage may vary, so there's a caveat on that. So as long as you're okay with doing your updates at least once a week, then you should be fine.
Yay!
Next up, so this is not so much like something I wanted to tell anybody else about, but I'm actually asking questions to you, dear listeners. So we're getting our house done up at the moment, which is why I've been in and out over the last couple of weeks. But I see a golden opportunity to finally have a networking cabinet underneath the stairs. So yeah, I'm just like, I'm going to ask all you fine gentlemen, or anyone else listening who has done something like this, who has lived in a house with like solid concrete walls and, Wi-Fi doesn't really penetrate as well as it could. And, you know, how the hell do you get Ethernet around a place like that with like these completely solid concrete walls that have no like space to put cables in the middle. I mean, I'm not complaining. Those walls are nice, but yeah, it's a kind of a pain in the ass if you want to run like Ethernet anywhere in the house. So answers on the back of a postcard if you have a similar situation.
Have you tried plugs?
I already use them, but they don't always work well for me. Like they work okay. They do the job, but like they severely limit like my speed. Like I think it's like half of what it could be when I use the power line adapters.
Mm-hmm. You could also do mesh networking. Ooh. Is an option. It's not always a great option and it can be expensive, but it is an option. So you've got like your primary access point is right by your router and it broadcasts wireless signal. So then you put a mesh point somewhere towards the edge of your regular access points range, and it sort of rebroadcasts the signal.
Yeah, that's always sounded like a cool idea. I just like the idea of it, that you can reach all the different nooks and crannies in your house.
Ubiquiti is the big name, one of the big names in this space, but there's also TP-Link has an Omada product line, and their mesh points and access points and routers and switches and everything are much cheaper than Ubiquiti's. It's not as wonderful an experience, but they're like half the price.
Yeah, it's surprising how much these things cost. Like the Powerline adapters alone were like at least 50 or 60 euro.
And that was the... Okay, so you have the TP-Link ones then.
Yeah.
I used to sell these in Maplin. I have, because I had staff discounts, I have the Devolo ones, and I've had them for, must have been almost 10 years. And they were all right, but they were all right when my internet wasn't all that fast normally. I've never tried it, actually, because I don't need it now. I never tried it on like a stronger connection. If you want to, I can. You can have mine. I haven't used them in a while. And by that, I mean years. So
could be an option.
I have two, yeah. But we also used to sell mesh networking kits. And these were kits from like, I think either BT or some big telco did like a big box. And that was about 350 euros, just like three nodes, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, it's either that or I get a masonry drill and start like putting holes in walls. Next up. I'm going to go to you, Connor. We haven't spoken to you in a while. I want you to tell us about this Mycroft story, actually, because this is something that passed us by and we didn't get to talk about it in recent weeks.
So what I've linked in the show notes here is a blog post from the CEO. My understanding of it is that a patent company or a company that had acquired a certain patent took Mycroft to court and then they were caught up in that, legal fees, everything like that. So that was a drain on their financial resources. And then after a long time of being caught up in that, then the company that was taking them to court decided to drop it or they resolved it in some other way. But on the basis of that, the CEO is pretty much saying, yeah, we've lost a crap ton of money to that. That they've been drained, which is a shame because Mycroft has been going on for quite a while. I think Shane, way back in the early episodes of this podcast, you're quite excited about the Mycroft project,
yeah,
and the idea of it, that a free and open source voice assistant. So it had a lot of potential, and it's a shame to see that it might not be a viable project. Obviously, it's free and open source, so it's not so they're. All of that is not wasted effort. It's still out there, but you know, a viable company, a viable business model that they would able to continue and be able to sustain themselves. It's a shame that they're not able to do that.
Yeah, fuck patent trolls, basically. Because yeah, just like absolute parasites, they can all go jump off a bridge. As far as I'm concerned, Yeah, I hate that kind of thing. Like, but because that was a company I was really rooting for, and I really loved the idea of it. Like, I tried out the Mycroft One software on my PC. You could actually just install it, and just if you had a microphone and speakers, you could interact with it. And you know, it wasn't fantastic. It was fine. It was a voice assistant. It did what it was supposed to. It didn't really do very many things, though. It didn't have a lot of integrations with stuff, so. You know, there was only so much you could do with it other than like set reminders or, you know, interact with a few select apps. But yeah, it was quite limited at the time. But yeah, as Connor said, they will have like the software and all the work out there in the public domain. So someone can build upon that.
I remember cheering Mycroft on a lot when they announced that they were going to fight the patent trolls and throw all this money at them. And now I'm kind of regretting that because it's sort of, at least according to these blog posts, led to the death of Mycroft. And that sucks. But there is another one to sort of keep an eye on. It's called Leon. GetLeon.ai. It's an open source personal assistant.
I'm looking at it right now.
I haven't tried it. I don't know what all it does. I don't know what all it's supposed to do eventually. But it's one to watch, I guess, if Mycroft is actually dying.
So this project seems to, they only do the software, right?
Yeah, they don't do any hardware.
I mean, that could be cool. You could have like a company that just goes all in on developing the software and then releases maybe like a reference spec for a device that, you know, they have tested on or something. It's like, hey, if you can create this device somehow and put it into a nice casing or whatever and make it look cool, then go ahead and make your own product with our software.
Or just put it onto a Raspberry Pi and use it. I think that's, you could do that already with Mycroft.
That was basically what Mycroft was, yeah. I think that the brains of it were, but the brains of the Mycroft 1 device, I think, was just a Raspberry Pi as well.
Yeah, Pycroft.
The thing that I can see here is that something has to translate the text into speech, and the part that seems to be doing that, like you can choose your text-to-speech backend for Leon.ai, and they give you the following options: Google Cloud, AWS, IBM Watson, something that's a CMU file, I'm not sure what it is, and then Alibaba Cloud and Microsoft Azure coming soon.
CMU Flight is an, if I remember correctly, an offline open source text-to-speech engine.
All right, so that could... Yeah, sorry, I misread it. I'm looking at it on small screen, so I thought it said CMU file. It's a CMU mm-hmm. flight. But wasn't there a Mozilla text-to-speech engine?
That's what Mycroft was going to use.
Open Voice, maybe?
Common Voice or something? Or
yeah, I think so, yeah.
I think it was called Project Common Voice or something like that. Yeah, but there was an open source voice database, like voice models.
It's not an actual engine.
Yeah.
It's just the training data.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
So, I think we'll move on. Amulet, I'll go to you next. Abhorrent spam issues in XMPP.
So, for those that are unfamiliar, group chats in XMPP are called MUCs, multi-user chats. And pretty much every MUC I was in started getting like random users joining, sending an image. You ban them, and then 30 minutes later, an hour later, something like that, another one joins, posts an image or two, you ban them, and this goes on repeat everywhere for multiple days. And I'm not going to go into detail on the images, but they were disgusting. No one should ever have to see that. But the one good thing that came out of this terrible situation is all of the XMPP server implementations and most of the clients, because of this, poured a lot of development effort into the clients and servers and whatnot to improve the moderation tooling, which is fantastic. Procity has a new module. It's a real-time blacklist. So a bunch of people are in members of a MUC, and they can interact with a bot in that MUC to ban a Jabber ID or a handle. That Jabber ID gets added to this real-time blacklist, this central list of a bunch of stuff that should be banned everywhere. And then all of the XMPP servers subscribed to this list immediately get that and ban it themselves, preemptively ban that ID. So one server operator sees this thing, they're like, okay, this should be banned. It's banned everywhere else too.
Hmm.
And some of the clients are also getting these abilities. So in Chiagram, for example, I can delete a message that someone else sent. Until recently, that wasn't a thing in XMPP, but it is now. So I can delete that message, and then other people in the MUC who have clients that support it, that message is removed for them as well. So what I wrote in the notes is this issue is propelling moderation tooling into 2015.
Yeah, I decided not to read that bit out because it seemed like it was a punchline.
it is.
Obviously, that sounds good on paper, and I'm sure 99.9% of server admins out there are honorable and would not abuse the system, but you can just imagine that, let's say, I have a personal vendetta against Amulet. He has done absolutely nothing wrong, but he literally just joined my server, and I go, hey guys, you totally should ban this guy's ID, and then he's banned everywhere. So it's potentially open to abuse.
That's why the real-time blacklist group is not exactly private, but people are added with care.
Mm.
And there could be an appeal. And if basically I'd imagine that if this was to be happening often enough, people would organize some way of appealing the decision.
Yeah. So far, it's just been used for accounts sending these images. It can be used for anything, but that's all it's been used for so far.
Nothing would be as good as being able to block IP blocks.
Well, banning based on IP is not effective, really, because there are VPNs and people behind NAT. So then you ban one NAT IP address, and then you've banned a whole group of people on the other side.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so basically people should stop being assholes.
Yes, that's the solution.
It's a cleaner solution for sure. I think we'll move on. Connor, you have an interesting link in there. KDE and GNOME join hands to add payments to FlatHub.
Yeah, so I came across this on Reddit. Essentially, it's the KDE and GNOME projects, or GNOME projects, want to collaborate on a payment structure for FlatHub. So you can just imagine you can go into FlatHub and maybe there's a suggested donation of $10 to this developer or something like that, like the way that the
Elementary,
yeah, where they have a suggested cost and then you can just blank that out and say no, zero. It's certainly a step in the right direction. I know that as Amleth said, the Elementary OS people have been trying to do this for a while. It seems to have had a moderate amount of success, but within their own ecosystem. So I think this is a step in a larger direction of it being available for everyone, not just in the Elementary store or whatever.
Meanwhile, none of Ubuntu or its official flavors are going to be able to take advantage of that.
By default.
Yeah, by default. Because Canonical has disallowed snaps from all of them. Nope.
FlatHub.
Oh my god.
Yeah, they disallowed flatbacks. Oh no.
I started that rumor. No, so what happened is that Canonical, who is supporting a lot of their flavors with infrastructure and stuff, has decided that by default none of them will be providing flatback functionality out of the box. The wording on the post that will also be in the show notes was like, the flavors have all agreed to do this. I'm not going to go into, I don't know what's behind this. Like, I can see why Canonical would do that. There are two competing technologies. They like the one they make. They are also providing a lot of resources to flavors for free, I'd imagine. And they want to propagate their technology. You know, it might not be the best way to select the best technology, but it is, it is capitalism, I think. And the ones of us, like me, for example, who really think, I like Flatpak better than Snaps because that's where the most push is. I don't think I'm qualified to actually evaluate them technologically, but I can see it from the organizational point of view, where basically the only one who's promoting Snaps is Canonical, and they are focusing on the server, whereas the big two desktop technologies and some other and a few big distros are basically cooperating together on Flatpak. So that tells me that when it comes to containerized application technology for desktop, I probably want to choose Flatpak because there's going to be more choice and more effort from many more places. Even after all, if Canonical gets bought in a month and they decide that they need to cut off the desktop altogether, then we still have Flatpak, but we probably wouldn't have Snaps. Plus, it basically, the whole ecosystem is more kind of community driven and more robust and resilient to my naive enthusiast eyes. But I wouldn't. I just say one thing: there was a lot of crap being flung at Canonical for this. I think they are perfectly within their rights to do this kind of thing, and if I don't like it, there's a million other distros to choose than just Ubuntu or Ubuntu flavors. And if the flavors themselves don't like it, they can stop become flavors. Like, you have Mint and Elementary that are not official flavors and that they can provide whichever technology they want to. And if you are on Ubuntu and want Flatpak, you can always install it as well.
The big thing I don't like about this is Flatpaks and Snaps were both supposed to solve the problem of, or one of the problems they were both supposed to solve was adding PPAs to Debian and getting like unofficial software from other locations. But with Canonical basically disallowing Flatpaks from Ubuntu and all of its derivatives, the normal people that install Ubuntu or its derivatives are going to go want some piece of software, and it's not going to be available in the Snap store. And then they're going to have to go drop to a command line and do this other stuff to enable Flathub. While Canonical could just say, okay, they can coexist. We're not going to focus on Flatpak. We're going to put up a big warning saying, hey, this is unsupported, but we're going to let you do it anyway. This just kind of, I feel like this is a step back.
It's VHS and Beta all over again, and it's Blu-ray and HD DVD, and ultimately whichever the pornography industry chooses is the one that's going to win.
So will porn choose Flatpak or Snaps, I wonder.
I do understand Canonical's decision. It's perfectly within their rights to do all of this. I just don't like it.
Yeah, because the porn industry is well known for its open source projects.
I'm pretty sure that, you know, if you are Pornhub, you probably run a lot of Linux, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and I suppose, and given what they do, they probably have to, they probably can't have contracts with certain vendors. So, you know, because people just don't touch, like, that kind of thing. They're like, oh, no, not for me.
A lot of in-house stuff.
Yeah, they probably have a lot of in-house stuff that they have to come up themselves. So you never know. The Pornhub GitHub. The Pornhub GitHub could be like really, really great if it ever existed.
Jesus Christ. Oh, anyway.
You heard it here first, okay?
Let's move on.
I'm genuinely curious, though. Now that I think of it, I would actually love to hear something about like Pornhub software stack or, you know, just like, I'd be very curious. I don't know why. Anyway, yeah, I don't really know where to go with that. What next? What have we not talked about yet? Mike, tell us about US school buses.
Yeah, I mean it is a piece of technology, right? So as you gentlemen will be hearing from me for about half a year, I've been on holidays in the Caribbean. It was amazing. But one thing that I discovered is, so I've never seen a US school bus apart from on TV. You know, they are quite distinct. You can't mistake them for anything else. You know, they've got the nose and then the box at the end on the axle that is kind of almost in the middle. And as we were driving from the airport being driven on a normal coach, I'm like, oh my God, what is all of these school buses? And turns out that when they are retired from the US school system, they are sold, probably not the only place they are sold to, but they are sold by and large to the Caribbean, where hotels and tourist organizations and so on buy them for private, you know, moving tourists around. Probably none of them actually end up shipping children around because the poor kids there have to walk. But I wondered why, and it turns out that thing can climb a fucking mountain. Like, I wouldn't have believed that, right? But they took us to see a school on one of these, and it was going almost upright. It was screaming, it was it was shaking and everything, but it got us to a place where a normal bus probably would not be able to even dream of going.
Yeah, so, you know, sometimes old and reliable is best.
My truck is an antique as of this year.
Do you get like a special license plate and you don't have to pay tax or something?
Yes.
Oh, awesome.
I get a special license plate and I never need another inspection.
What do you drive? If you don't mind saying.
A 92 pickup truck. So it's 31 years old.
To making everyone here feel old, yeah. The 92 is considered an antique.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in the US, or specifically in North Carolina, vehicles are considered vintage or antique or whatever after 30 years.
I suppose that makes sense. I used to work in insurance, and how they do it here is you would insure it as a classic vehicle. So it would be really small insurance, but there'd be a lot of like caveats attached to it. So you would have a limit on how much you could drive it every year. And literally you would be insured on driving it from where it was stored to the car show that you were showing it off at. So it really was for like actual vintage cars, like that you would show off at car shows and stuff.
But you wouldn't have like 30 years old cars done that way here, would you?
You could. It depends. I mean, it just depends. I think the threshold is a bit more than 30 years though. I'm not sure though. I think it depends on the car.
It's a weird mental thing, but like, needless to say, something from the 70s or something from the 80s would ultimately qualify for that. But in my mind, I'm like, yeah, a vintage old classic car is like a Model T that goes around going.
Yeah, exactly.
So in Ireland, everybody has new cars, partially because it's a rich country and partially because it's surrounded by sea, so everything kind of falls apart very quickly because of the rust.
Never thought of it that way.
Where I'm from, my grandmother had an early 1980s Skoda for, 30 years, I think. And that she wasn't alone. Even if you go back there, like, you see cars that probably should be in a museum and aren't. They keep them, they keep them for longer. And I think in order for you to have an antique, it would have to be basically pre-war or maybe from the 50s.
Yeah, it's like here, like my car is 15 years old and the tax on it is way higher than if it was a newer car. And also you have to get it like inspected every single year and your insurance is going to be higher and stuff. Like, yeah, there's just like a lot of hidden costs to having an older car here. So it's actually more cost effective sometimes to just have a newer car because it's kind of cheaper to run. So, yeah, they kind of just like strong arm you into buying a newer car. I think I have it's not a theory. I think it's pretty much well known fact is that like the motor industry have a big lobby in Ireland because so many people buy a car here. So they just tweak the rules so people will always be buying new cars constantly.
That's another thing. Kind of English speaking countries have larger sprawling suburbs and less efficient public transportation, in my experience anyway. And I haven't been to the US, but I assume that's the case there too. So everybody has a car.
It's abysmal here.
Everybody needs you need kind of a car to move around.
Yes.
Yeah. And Dublin has Dublin's public transport is relatively okay, I think. People complain about it, but I think it's more or less fine.
It's improving.
It's definitely not on the level of like other cities I've been to, for sure. But it's getting there.
The Lewis is quite good, where it's every 10 minutes, whereas to a German, that would be in an absolute eternity. It's like, my transport is every 4 minutes. What is this? It should be every 2 minutes. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, right?
Yeah, I went to Copenhagen and bus stop said like 2 minutes until the next bus. And all of them after was like 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes. It was like there was literally a bus every 2 minutes. And I was like, and then it actually arrived in 2 minutes. Can you believe that?
Well,
I've never seen that before in Dublin.
Yeah.
The sign would say like 2 minutes, then 3 minutes, then 4 minutes, then back down to two, then three again, then one, and then it just disappears off the sign and never arrives.
That's the regular thing. It would literally disappear off the sign. My exposure to very efficient transport was the London Underground, the Tube. And I was like, if something was that reliable and that dependable, oh, my life would completely and utterly change. So I was like, I definitely could get used to this, the whole thing of the London Underground being so efficient and so dependable. I was like, oh, so this is what transport is supposed to be like.
Yeah, well, don't forget, Dublin will have its metro in just 10 to 12 years' time.
The first time I experienced good public transport was when we were in Prague.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, but then again, I'm telling you, Prague is condensed people build up rather than to the sprawl. So, and car people in the 60s and 70s, people will, if you wanted a car, you waited 10 years for that thing, right? I'm exaggerating, but you know, it wasn't like you can go and buy yourself a car easily. So public transport worked, and it's easier to do if you have a condensed city. It's difficult if you have to have long lines that will pick up one person per kilometer. It gets more expensive as well.
Yeah. It's like our public transport falls somewhere in between like a European capital and then like most cities in America, you know, where it's like public transport? Isn't that thing the poor people use?
It's beautiful. I don't know why people like driving so much, because you can read on a public transport. You can do whatever you can.
You kind of have no choice in America in some places, as far as I know.
Yeah. There's just not public transport in most places, or at least around where I live in most places. In the big cities, yeah, it does exist. And it's one of the best ways to get around. But America is just like so spread out. The cities are spread out and everything within the city is also spread out.
Hmm. Yeah.
So getting anywhere pretty much requires a car.
Okay.
Unless you're in like a college town. Here we have a bus system, and at my apartment, the bus comes by every 15 minutes. But where I was last semester, it came by every 30 minutes. So if you miss the one right before your class, well, you're going to miss class.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good place to wrap things up. What do you think?
I do want to talk about my last one, if that's all right.
Okay. So Amaleth, you can wrap this up. I can't pronounce some of those things, so you go ahead.
So for Geo and Renovate and Woodpecker is an excellent combo. Forgeo is a fork of Gitti. Gitti's project leads decided they were going to make a for-profit company using the Gitti name and branding. And all of that would be fine, except they were not transparent at all about any of it. They just kind of published a blog post saying, hey, we're a company now, and a bunch of other stuff. And that scared a lot of people off. Codeberg and some Gitti contributors decided they were going to fork Gitti into Forgeo, and it's already been like set up with its own domain. I think it already has a nonprofit, and that nonprofit owns the branding and the trademark and everything. So it's already, from a legal standpoint, been set up very well.
What does it do?
Forgeo and Gitti and all that is a Git platform, like a self-hosted GitHub, sort of. And I've been using it for a while, for personal stuff and for my business stuff. Recently, I discovered a tool called Renovate, which is like a self-hosted Dependabot. And Dependabot is a GitHub thing that scans through your project's dependencies and opens a pull request when any of your dependencies need to be updated. Renovate does the same thing, but it supports Gitti and by extension Forgeo. So you don't have to worry about keeping on top of dependency updates because it lets you know. And it also, like, it injects the change log into the pull request. So you can open the pull request, see, hey, this stuff needs to be updated. This is the old version. This is the new version. This is what I'll change. These are the breaking changes. You click a button and it's merged. It's really simple, and I've been loving it. Woodpecker is a CI/CD system, sort of like GitHub Actions in a way. And it integrates with Forgeo on a very deep level. So the pull requests opened by Renovate to update your dependencies can trigger Woodpecker pipelines to do automated testing and building to make sure that dependency update doesn't break anything. And it also automates deploys and all that kind of stuff. The setup with these three components is the most self-hosted GitHub setup I've ever seen, and I've been using it extensively for my business the past couple of months. It's been great, and I highly recommend it. And all those components are open source.
Nice. Well, it's actually a very good recommendation to go out on. I think we're going to leave it there for this fortnight. When this goes out, this will probably have been delayed, so apologies. That's, you know, kind of my fault, I guess, because of this blasted house renovation. And yeah, that's just kind of throwing everything off. So we should return to a normal cadence within a few weeks. We've got a very special episode lined up next time, so keep an eye out for that. We won't say what it is, just in case. But if you want to reach out to us, obviously linuxlads.com/contact. But the best way, the most surefire way to get in touch with us is show@linuxlads.com. So send us an email. We read all the emails that we get. And yeah, always just the best, most direct way to send any feedback to the show or anything you want us to shout out. And we also have a Ko-fi. It's kind of like a Patreon, so you can go there and we have different tiers and stuff. You can sponsor us for a time or just give us like a one-off donation, whatever you fancy doing. So we're building up a really nice collection of links now, so it's kind of unwieldy to read them all out. So just go to linuxlads.com/contact and they'll all be there. Okay, I think that's us for this fortnight, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Adios. Wait. We go from porn to U.S. school buses.
Oh, I'm sure they've been used.
We all knew that was an awkward segue, but we're going to run with it anyway.